Welcome to Tuned to Yesterday, broadcasting programs from the golden age of radio. I'm your host, Mark Levonier, with you for an hour of true history. Radio has had an interesting, controversial, pioneering, and tumultuous history when it comes to the involvement of African Americans and their issues as citizens on the air. Before television, with radio in its heyday, the country was still a ways from the 1954 ruling in Brown v. Board of Education or the landmark Civil Rights Act of 1964, meaning that any sense of fair portrayal, equal acting opportunities, or a balanced amount of time for coverage of civil rights issues was really left up to the directors of programs and, in many cases, a program sponsor. To this end, many blacks who were working in the entertainment industry were mostly relegated to subservient roles on the air, and even though actors like Eddie Anderson from Jack Benny or singer Paul Robeson had center stage when they were on the air, in a 1940s America, these men could still not find a hotel room when visiting a city, or in some places be in the same part of a hospital for care as white people. So when one looks back at the level of racism in our country, coupled with what was on the air during the 1930s and 40s, it seems today that broadcasts that unashamedly tackle issues of African Americans at that time are not only extremely valuable, but an important contribution that helped to serve the changes and reform we as a nation have seen since. In this hour, we'll hear three forward-thinking broadcasts. Later on, Orson Welles and a commentary on ABC's Lear. A brief from newsman Elmer Davis with a Supreme Court decision. But right now, it's an open letter on race hatred, broadcast on the CBS radio network on July 24, 1943, which tells the three-day story of the Detroit race riot, which happened from June 20th to the 22nd of 1943.
What you are about to hear may anger you. What you are about to hear may sound incredible to you. You may doubt that such things can happen today in this supposedly united nation. But we assure you, everything you are about to hear is true. And so we ask you to spend 30 minutes with us, facing quietly and without passion or prejudice a danger which threatens all of us. A danger so great that if it is not met and conquered now, even though we win this war, we shall be defeated in victory. And the peace which follows will for us be a horror of chaos, lawlessness, and bloodshed. This danger is race hatred. Tonight, race hatred is breeding and festering in a score of booming, overcrowded war centers. So tonight, we ask you to hear what happened in Detroit, because we believe that no sensible, fully informed American will allow to happen again, here at home, what he is fighting against all over the world. Sunday, June 20th, was hot. Detroit, sprawling across the flat Michigan prairie, baked in the nearly vertical sun. In the workers' camps on the fringe of the city, trailers and tents held the heat close and unbreathable. In the crowded flats and overflowing houses along Tireman and Epworth Boulevard in the Negro District, the heat pressed down like the sweaty hand of John Henry. The Poles and Hamtramck felt it, and the two and three families crammed into one-family apartments. Their tempers grew shorter as the day lengthened from one hot hour to another. Those who could find any way to get there headed for lovely Belle Isle in the Detroit River and a breath of fresh air. But when the flat, hot sun dropped into the lake on the other side of Michigan, the twilight brought little relief. And still sweating, tempers shortened even more, they started home to another sticky, sleepless night. The traffic moved slowly across the bridge from Belle Isle, cars creeping bumper to bumper, the crowds on foot filling the sidewalk. Something happened there, No one is quite sure what. But something happened that hot Sunday last month. Something in itself trivial. Something like this.
Eddie, you're not going to get us home any faster by blowing the horn.
If that guy ahead will just move forward, I can get into the other line.
Oh, Eddie, don't...
Shut up. There, now I got a break. Did you see that? He pulled out right in front of me. Hey, you stupid jerk.
What's the big idea, bud?
Oh, a Negro,
now,
huh?
Eddie.
Listen, you, get out of that car and I'll show you. You black punk.
Eddie, please.
I'll show him.
Jackie.
What's the idea, bud?
You know how crowds are. Nothing like a good fight. You push up as close as you can and you get pushed. And it's usually all in good fun. But this crowd was tired and hot and full of deep-seated grievances that June evening. It promptly took sides, and taking sides, broke up into other fights. And those out on the edge couldn't tell what was going on. And the reports they got were garbled. They got garbled worse.
What's going on?
A couple of guys fighting. The black boy's quite a baby with his fist.
A fight about a baby on the Belle Isle Bridge.
A baby sewed off a Belle Isle Bridge.
Yeah, I tell you, Lucius just got back from Belle Isle. He saw it. There was a big fight, and a white fella throwed a colored woman and her baby off the bridge into the river, and they was drowned.
That's the way the rumor hit the slums of Paradise Valley, the Negro section, a month ago. And it spread. There was another rumor, the white version.
What's the trouble?
I don't know. Tangled bumpers, I guess. That's the white guy's gal sitting in the car.
They're fighting over a white girl on the Belle Isle Bridge.
There's plenty of trouble over on Belle Isle, Negro and a white gal.
Negro attacked a white gal over on Belle Isle. Call up the guys.
Rumor. More dangerous than dynamite. More deadly than a plague. Rumors tailor-made. One for black ears. One for white ears. Stories about things that never had happened. The trouble had started.
But just because a couple of men had a fight on the Belle Isle Bridge?
Oh, no. It goes much deeper than that, much further back.
Really?
Yes, back nearly a quarter of a century. You see, Detroit grew up fast.
I'll say it did, brother. Want some figures on that?
Why, yes, if you don't mind.
Not at all. That's what I'm here for. From 1920 to 1930, while Detroit was putting the world on wheels, our population increased by 500,000. And today, we're on our way to... Pardon me, I see some prospects. Hey, you, mister. How'd you like to work in a defense plant in Detroit?
Oh, not me. I got a good job at the tire factory right here in Akron.
How about you?
Pittsburgh's good enough for me. We gotta make the steel before you can make the tanks.
What do you say, pal?
Listen, lay off, will you? Toledo's got its own manpower problem.
Okay. No harm in asking. Hey, you down there in South Carolina.
Oh, me?
Yeah, you. How'd you like to come up north and work in the defense plant?
Well, now, I hadn't thought about it.
Pay the highest wages, better than you can make in the cotton mill.
Yeah?
Yeah. You'll be living high on the hog in Detroit. Beautiful town, right on the lake. Bring along the missus and the kids.
Well, I'll think about it.
You can clean up quick in Detroit, and after the war, you can go back down south and retire.
I could, huh?
Sure. Report Monday?
Yeah, mister. Sure, and thanks.
Pardon me.
Yeah, what?
Why are you recruiting labor in the South when you've already got a big supply of labor in Detroit?
What are you talking about?
The Negroes.
Listen, bud, we're not hiring any Negroes.
But the War Manpower Commission has ordered that local labor had to be exhausted before you
could
go out.
Maybe they did, but they're not enforcing the order, and we don't want any black...
Hey, boss, I got a message for you.
Yeah? What is it? Oh, not back?
Yeah, so you better do something fast.
Okay. Pardon me, pal.
Go right ahead.
Hey, boy!
Yes, sir?
Want a good job?
I sure do. Well, what do I have to do for it?
Nothing. Just come to Detroit.
Detroit?
Sure. Work in the war plants, making tanks and guns.
Sure enough.
On the level.
But I'm a field hand. I don't know nothing about working in no factory.
It's all right.
We'll teach you.
Well, I
You
don't
can know. Make more in a month than you get in a year working in the field.
Is that a fact?
Yeah. Plenty of chance for advancement, too.
Advancement?
Yeah. Nothing to hold you back in Detroit. Why,
If you make the grade, we might even promote you to store boss.
You ain't just joshing me.
No, sirree. And you'll be living in paradise in Detroit.
Paradise?
Well, Paradise Valley.
Mister, that sounds too good to be true.
I can count on you?
Yes, sir. You sure can. You sure can.
But didn't you say a minute ago that you didn't want any Negro labor?
Yeah, but I just got word that the boys back home have changed their minds. They've hired all the Negroes in Detroit, and we got to get more labor. Lots more.
More. Lots more. In 3 years, Detroit has imported 500,000 Negroes and whites, mostly from the South.
That's right. As many people as live in New Orleans, the state of Arizona. It's a big operation.
It certainly is. But Detroit doesn't have houses for a 500,000 extra people. Detroit doesn't have enough streetcars and buses to move the state of Arizona back and forth from work. Detroit doesn't have enough parks or movie houses or bowling alleys to entertain an additional New Orleans.
Today, it is impossible to rent a decent house within 50 miles of Detroit.
No houses, but jobs, plenty of jobs for black and white, for Native Americans and Polish-born immigrants. And all the prejudices of Detroit's polyglot population awaited the new army of war workers. Subversive organizers and native Nazi orators took to soapboxes outside a dozen war plants.
I'd rather see Hitler and Hirohito win than work beside a Negro on the assembly line.
Detroit was dynamite. The fist fight on the Belle Isle Bridge set off the fuse. By the dawn of Monday, June 21st, Detroit blew up. That bloody Monday, Woodward Avenue, the wide boulevard which divides the city, became a hunting ground upon which no Negro was safe. Along Hastings Street in the heart of Paradise Valley, bands of Negroes, fired by rumors, smashed the windows of white storekeepers, overturned the cars of white motorists, and were shot by the police. On Woodward Avenue, 100,000 white men armed with lengths of pipe and beer bottles beat up Negroes until their arms ached.
Great factories of Detroit, which proudly claims the title of Arsenal of Democracy, few men worked that day. From bloody dawn to bloody dawn in that single day, these insurrectionists wasted 1 million man hours. How many of your sons will die for lack of the tanks and planes and guns which Detroit did not make that day?
We lost Bataan gallantly. We surrendered Corregidor with honor. We were defeated at Detroit by ourselves in shame and humiliation. But not all Detroit went blind with bloodlust that hot Monday. There were black people and white people whose conduct proved them, first of all, to be human beings. There was a prominent Negro doctor who was leaving his office on his way to an emergency meeting of city officials at the Negro Y when the white druggist in his building called to him.
Dr. Johnson. Dr. Johnson.
Oh, Mr. Stewart. You shouldn't have opened your store this morning.
I didn't know how bad it was. Now I don't know what to do.
Well, You'd better close up and go home.
I'm afraid they'd mob me before I got to Woodward Avenue.
Yes, yes, they might. I'll tell you. You lock up right now, and I'll drive you through.
But you'd be taking a chance, too.
You're my friend, Mr. Stewart.
And the white man was driven through the threatening, jeering Negro mob by his colored friend to safety, close to the no-man's land of Woodward Avenue. And there were white people, too, who acted with sanity and bravery on that insane day. In a streetcar crawling through the mobs on Woodward Avenue sat a woman and her daughter.
Oh, Mother, look at them beating up that poor man.
Lieutenant.
It's disgraceful. Outrageous.
Oh, look. The mob's coming towards this car.
Now, don't get excited, Elsie.
There's a colored man sitting across the aisle. Oh, Mother,
well,
I'm afraid.
Well, they won't get him. You, mister, you. Come here.
Yes, ma'am.
Quick, get down here under the seat.
Mother, what are you going
to do? Be quiet, Elsie. Spread out your skirt so you hide him.
Oh.
God bless you, ma'am.
Oh.
Any Negroes inside?
There are not.
Okay, ma'am. Just want to make sure. All right, boys, let's go.
God bless you, ma'am. God bless you.
Now, you stay right where you are until we get out of this. Those hoodlums. I've lived all my life in Detroit, and today I'm ashamed of it.
And there were three sailors that bloody Monday who proved how much courage a mob has.
Let me go. I ain't done nothing. I'm just on my way home from work.
Ah, shut up, you dirty.
Let me get away. Let that man go. Let him go.
Well, a U.S. Navy to the rescue. Hey, you got friends, eh, Bob?
Let him go, please.
Let him go.
What's it to you, sailor?
I'll tell you, bum.
Who are you calling the bum?
I'm just paying off a debt. There was a colored guy on my ship that saved the life of one of my buddies.
You got me weeping.
Hey, give this fella a hand.
Right. Come along, kid. We'll get you out of this.
Thank you, sailor. Thank you.
Listen, Cobb, if you didn't have that uniform on, you wouldn't get away with that.
Okay. I'll be glad to oblige. I'll take it off. Ace, you better peel off your jumper, too.
A pleasure.
Would you mind holding these for us, kid?
Sure thing, sailor.
Okay, you punks. Do you want to take us on one at a time or both together?
Well, we ain't picking no fights with white men. We're after colored guys.
Yeah. And you're stirring up the kind of trouble we went to war to stop. Now, you jerks better get off the streets before the army gets into town and starts using you for target practice.
Late that night, the army finally did arrive. And for the first time in 24 hours, a fitful peace reluctantly fell on the debris-filled streets of Detroit. The score?
1,800 arrested. 85% Negroes.
600 injured, the majority Negroes.
35 dead. 29 Negroes. 17 of them shot by the police.
Accomplished
nothing.
Two nights after the troops arrived, the class of 1943 was graduated at Northeastern High School. Its members included 29 Negro boys and girls. The sincere words of the commencement speaker that night seemed tinged with bitter irony.
Analyze the problems of today. See if you can work out your own destiny through democratic process. You must if democracy is to survive. The world cannot go on half free and half slave.
In the park outside the high school, 80 policemen stand on guard. And behind them, little groups of hoodlums, toughened by 2 days of street fighting, gather in the shadows.
Democracy is more than just casting your ballot. It is something that must be lived 24 hours each day. It is learning to live collectively.
A lesson their elders had proved that they had not learned. A challenge difficult to accept when you have for 2 days watched democracy go up in the smoke of burning automobiles and trickle away in the bloody gutters. It is nearly over. The last moments of their 4 years together. Their last song together. Black and white voices blending. The hoodlums out in the park hear the song through the open windows. The mob begins to form. The policemen stiffen, glance nervously about. And then the song is over, and with congratulations and well wishes cut short by the 10 o'clock curfew, the Negro and white members of the Northeastern High School, class of 1943, step out into the world. The police line wavers. The girl graduates in their summery dresses cringe. The boys stand there a moment indecisively.
I'm not going to let them think they can scare me. Come on, who's walking my way?
I'll go with you.
So will I.
The three classmates, two Negro, one white, start down the street. Across the way, behind the line of police, the mob paces them.
Don't walk too fast.
Geez, I'm being inducted into the Army next week to fight for them.
Doesn't seem worth it.
At the street corner, the mob breaks through the police line, sweeps across the street, and then suddenly halts. Four truckloads of soldiers with fixed bayonets roll up to a stop.
All right, boys, and the devil, clear the area. All right, you guys, move on out. Break it up.
Slowly, at the point of the bayonet, the rabble of Kluxers, cowards, and crackpots retreat into the shadows once they came. Northeastern High School, class of 43, has graduated without bloodshed. So an armed peace came to the troubled streets of Detroit. And most of us, knowing little and perhaps caring less why such things occur, forgot about it. But not the rest of the world.
Hello, here is Radio Berlin calling in the Asiatic Service. The disturbances in Detroit have now also come to an end, owing to the intervention of the troops whom Roosevelt dispatched to the scene. There is no doubt about the fact that the problem of labor and capital cannot be solved by the present rulers of the USA.
And listen to the voice of Tokyo addressing the billion brown and yellow inhabitants of Asia.
The Detroit riot of June the 20th, in which hundreds of Negroes were sacrificed to the altar of American white superiority complex, was nothing more than the latest of acts of intolerable cruelty of the people who pay lip service to democracy. How can America hope to bring an order of liberty and equality among the more complicated, vastly more difficult family of races in the world when it can't manage its own race problem? It simply can't.
Those words have the ring of logic to millions of people all around the world. Millions who look upon us with justified suspicion. And the question those words pose is not rhetoric, but literal. The answer lies with each one of us. We cannot command the respect of mankind with the blood of fellow Americans upon our hands. There are some places in the nation where citizens are showing common sense, tact, and tolerance. In Houston, Texas, for instance, last month, rumors were launched that there would be a race riot on Saturday, June 19th, when the Negro population celebrates the anniversary of the Emancipation Proclamation in the festival they call Juneteenth. A committee of prominent Negro and white citizens, headed by the mayor, stopped the trouble before it started with a full-page advertisement in the Houston papers, which read,
"Don't do Hitler's work. Stop circulating rumors which create tenseness and interfere with war production, and attend to your own business. The colored people of this vicinity are entitled to celebrate their traditional Juneteenth holiday on Saturday, pleasantly and in peace. And the fact that they gather for their customary celebration on that day is no evidence of any intention on their part to create a disturbance. Law enforcement authorities are prepared to deal with thoughtless hoodlums, white or colored, who provoke trouble. Don't be a rumor monger."
There was no riot in Houston on June 19th. Because decent, law-abiding citizens saw one coming and did something about it. Each of us can do the same thing in his community. It's not the people who serve on the committees and lead the parades and make the speeches who will stop race hatred. It's each one of us. Each anonymous citizen keeping his head on his shoulders, his fists unclenched, and his mouth shut. We've got too tough an enemy to beat overseas, to fight each other here at home. We hope that this open letter about the irreparable damage race hatred has already done to our prestige, our war effort, and our self-respect will have moved you to make a solemn promise to yourself that wherever you are, and whatever is your color or your creed, you will never allow intolerance or prejudice of any kind to make you forget that you are first of all an American, with sacred obligations to every one of your fellow citizens. Sincerely yours, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Ladies and gentlemen, as a postscript to our open letter to you, we present Mr. Wendell Willkie.
This is a time for serious thought and sober words. For the situation which flared so tragically in Detroit has its counterpart, actual or potential, in many American cities. Such instances of mob madness cannot be treated as single cases because they are profound in their effect in this country and lasting in their impression throughout the world. 2/3 of the people who are allied with us do not have white skin, and they have long, hurtful memories of the white man's superior attitude in his dealings with them. Today, the white man is professing friendship and a desire to cooperate, and is promising opportunity in the world to come when the world is over. They wonder, when the necessities of war cease to make cooperation valuable to the white man, will his promises mean anything? Race riots in Detroit, Los Angeles, and Beaumont, Texas, do not reassure them. The situation is grave, both at home and in its effects abroad. We must therefore seek the basic causes and find the ways for their elimination. Practical, direct, positive ways. 1/10 of the people in this country belong to the Negro race. In the spirit in which our independence was gained and our republic established, there are certain things these Negro citizens are entitled to, not as a matter of patronage or tolerance, but as a matter of right. They are entitled to protection under the law, and when their safety demands it, the prompt and vigorous enforcement of the law. It is their right that there shall be no discrimination between them in the administration of the law in federal, state, or local government. They are entitled to the same opportunity to acquire an education of the same quality as that given to other citizens. They should receive the same per capita expenditure of public monies for health and hospitalization as is allotted to other citizens. They have a right, as has every citizen, to the elimination of all arbitrary restrictions on voting through taxation or otherwise. Their right to work must equal that of any citizen, and their reward should be the same as the reward of any other citizen for the same job. Their economic opportunities should not be limited by their color. Last, they should have the rights of every citizen to fight for his country in any branch of her armed services. These are rights that the Negroes of our community is entitled to share with every other citizen. We must see to it that he gets them. But in addition to his rights are certain human needs, which he also shares with his fellow citizens. And they, too, must be cared for. The most pressing today for black and white is adequate and decent housing. If this cannot be secured through the operation of our private economy, it is an obligation that must be undertaken by government, preferably local, but if necessary, federal. There is one thing further which seems to me to have a real bearing on the welfare of the Negro citizen. It concerns the Negro's political status. Our two major political parties have their separate ways of approaching the Negro vote. One has a tendency to ask the Negro for his vote as recompense for an act of simple justice done 80 years ago. The other retains political power by, in effect, depriving the Negro of his right to vote in one part of the country while seeking his vote in another on the plea of great friendship for his race. Both attitudes must be changed. One party cannot go on feeling that it has no further obligation to the Negro citizen because Abraham Lincoln freed the slave, and the other is not entitled to power if it sanctions and practices one set of principles in Atlanta and another in Harlem. Our whole purpose today is with our allies to defeat fascism. All of the forces of fascism are not with our enemies. Fascism is an attitude of mind, an attitude which causes men to seek to rule others by economic, military, or political force, or through prejudice. Such an attitude within our own borders is as serious a threat to freedom as the attack without. The desire to deprive some of our citizens of their rights, economic, civil, or political, has the same basic motivation as actuates the fascist mind when it seeks to dominate whole peoples and whole nations. It is essential that we eliminate it at home as well as abroad.
An open letter on race hatred on Tuned to Yesterday from July 24, 1943 on CBS. You're listening to An Hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. I'm your host, Mark Levenier. And now one of many endeavors on air from Orson Welles, his program Lear, where he was given an opportunity to share his thoughts on the news and, in this next broadcast, the matters of civil rights. This from August 11, 1946 on ABC.
This is Orson Welles. I've spoken these words before, but not on the radio. To be born free is to be born in debt. To live in freedom without fighting slavery is to profiteer. By plane last night, I flew over some parts of our republic where American citizenship is a luxury beyond the means of the majority. I rode comfortably in my plane above a sovereign state or two where fellow countrymen of ours can't vote without the privilege of cash. I bought my breakfast this morning where Negroes may not come except to serve their white brothers. And there I overheard a member of some master race or other tell those who listened that something must be done to suppress the Jews. I have met Southerners who expect and fear a Negro insurrection. I see no purpose in withholding this from general discussion. There may be those within that outcast 10% of the American people who someday will strike back at their oppressors. But to put down that mob, a mob would rise. I'd like to ask, please, who will put down that mob? The scaly dinosaurs of reaction, if indeed they notice what I'm speaking here, will say in their newspapers that I'm a communist. Communist, no otherwise. I'm an overpaid movie producer with pleasant reasons to rejoice, and I do, in the wholesome practicability of the profit system. But surely my right to having more than enough is canceled if I don't use that more to help those who have less. My subject today is the question of moral indebtedness. So I'd like to acknowledge here the debt that goes with ownership. I believe, and this has very much to do with my own notion of freedom, I believe I owe the very profit I make to the people I make it from. If this is radicalism, it comes automatically to most of us in show business, it being generally agreed that any public man owes his position to the public. That's what I mean when I say I'm your obedient servant. It's a debt payable in service and the highest efforts of the debtor. The extension of this moral argument insists that no man owns anything outright since he owns it rent-free. A wedding never bought a wife. And the devotion of his child is no man's for the mere begetting. We must each day earn what we own. A healthy man owes to the sick all that he can do for them. An educated man owes to the ignorant all that he can do for them. A free man owes to the world's slaves all that he can do for them. And what is to be done is more, much more than good works, Christmas baskets, bonuses and tips, and bread and circuses. There is only one thing to be done with slaves. Free them. If we can't die in behalf of progress, we can live for it. Progress, we Americans take to mean a fuller realization of democracy. The measure of progress, as we understand it, is the measure of equality enjoyed by all men. We can do something about that. The way our fighting brothers and sisters looked at it, some of them dead as I speak these words, the way they looked at it, we're lucky. And they're right, we're lucky to be alive, but only if our lives make life itself worth dying for. We must be worthy of our luck or we are damned. Our lives were spared, but this is merely the silliest of accidents, unless we put the gift of life to to the hard employments of justice. If we waste that gift, we won't have anywhere to hide from the indignation of history. I want to say this. The morality of the auction block is out of date. There is no room in the American century for Jim Crow. The Times urge new militancy upon the democratic attitude. Tomorrow's democracy discriminates against discrimination. Its charter won't include the freedom to end freedom. What is described as a feeling against some races can't be further respected. Feeling is a ninnyish, mincing way of saying something ugly. But the word is good enough for race hate when we add that it's a feeling of guilt. Race hate isn't human nature. Race hate is the abandonment of human nature. But this is true. We hate whom we hurt, and we mistrust whom we betray. There are minority problems simply because minority races are often wronged. Race hate, distilled from the suspicions of ignorance, takes its welcome from the impotent and the godless, comforting these with hellish parodies of what they've lost. Arrogance to take the place of pride. Contempt to occupy the spirit emptied of the love of man. There are alibis for the phenomena, excuses, economic and social, but the brutal fact is simply this. Where the racist lie is acceptable, there is corruption. Where there is hate, there is shame. The human soul receives race hate only in the sickness of guilt. The Indian, the Red Indian, is on our American conscience. The Negro is on our conscience. The Chinese and the Mexican American are on our conscience. The Jew is on the conscience of Europe. But our neglect gives us communion in that guilt, so that there dances even here the lunatic specter of anti-Semitism. This is deplored, but it must be fought, and the fight must be won. The race haters must be stopped. The lynchings must be stopped. No matter who's going to be governor of Georgia, the murders in Monroe must be avenged. Jean Talmadge may call it foreign meddling, but the governor-elect who, you remember, campaigned on the Bilbo platform of race hate, needs to be told that all the states in the Union and all the people in them are concerned, immediately, personally concerned, when a mob forms in the sovereign privacy of Georgia. The mob said it was taking care of things in its own way. Well, then, we're going to have to take care of the mob in our own way. Those who take the law into their own hands are going to learn about some laws. We'll tie their hands. We'll write those laws and we'll enforce them. To do him justice, old Gene went and issued himself a statement. After the killings in Monroe were public knowledge, he said the killings were regrettable. But old Gene's made it plenty clear. He doesn't figure any foreigner's got the right to poke around and ask embarrassing questions. I am sending old Gene a copy of the Don sermon on the tolling bell, but I don't suppose he'll get the point. The point is, of course, that no man, even Gene Talmadge, is an island entire of itself. The point, of course, is that even Georgia is a piece of the continent. The American continent. And if a clod be washed away by the sea, or if a colored man and his wife are murdered on a dusty country road, America is the less. And then there's the soldier in the hospital. The blind soldier. The soldier says he was blinded. And the mayor and the chief of police in the place where the soldier says it happened are most indignant with me for repeating what he said and swore to. The Times the other day was full of their official protests, sent under seal all the way up to New York City from within the inviolable borders of Aiken County in South Carolina. My investigators are still hard at work on the case. If the soldier was wrong about the place, I'm going to do something about it. But if he isn't wrong about his eyes, he lost them. I'm going to do something about that. All the affidavits from all the policemen in the world won't protest his eyes back in his head. Somebody who called himself an officer of the law, beat that boy with a stick until he lost his sight. Now that somebody is nobody. He's vanished. He's never been heard of. He hasn't any name. Well, he's going to be heard of. The blind soldier has my promise of that. That somebody is going to be named. Editorials and lots of newspapers and lots of people are writing me the demand to know what business it is of mine. God judge me if it isn't the most pressing business I have. The blind soldier fought for me in this war. The least I can do now is fight for him. I have eyes. He hasn't. I have a voice on the radio. He hasn't. I was born a white man. And until a colored man is a full citizen like me, I haven't the leisure to enjoy the freedom that colored man risked his life to maintain for me. I don't own what I have until he owns an equal share of it. Until somebody beats me and blinds me, I am in his debt. And so I come to this microphone not as a radio dramatist, although it pays better, not as a commentator, although it's safer to be simply that. I come in that boy's name and in the name of all who in this land of ours have no voice of their own. I come with a call for action. This is a time for it. I call for action against the cause of riots. I know that to some ears, even the word action has a revolutionary twang, and it won't surprise me if I'm accused in some quarters of inciting to riot. Well, I'm very interested in riots. I'm very interested in avoiding them. And so I call for action against the cause of riots. Law is the best action, the most decisive. I call for laws, then, prohibiting what moral judgment already counts as lawlessness. American law forbids a man the right to take away another's right. It must be law that groups of men can't use the machinery of our republic to limit the rights of other groups, that the vote, for instance, can't be used to take away the vote. It's in the people's power to see to it that what makes lynchings and starts wars is dealt with, not by well-wishers, but by policemen, and I mean good policemen. Oh, for several generations, maybe there'll be men who can't be weaned away from the fascist vices of race hate. That we should deny such men responsibility in public affairs exactly as we deny responsibility to the wretched victims of the drug habit. There are laws against peddling dope. There can be laws against peddling race hate. That every man has a right to his own opinion is an American boast, but race hate is not an opinion, it's a phobia. It isn't a viewpoint. Race hate is a disease. In a people's world, the incurable racist has no rights. He must be deprived of influence in a people's government. He must be segregated, as he himself would segregate the colored and Semitic peoples, as we now segregate the leprous and the insane. Anything very big is very simple. If there's a big race question, there's a big answer to it, and a big answer is simple, like the word no. This is my proposition, that the sin of race hate be solemnly declared a crime. What makes this difficult is the conservative fear of raising issues. Well, let's admit that this fear is often no more sinister than an honest dread of going to the dentist, but let's respect the effectiveness of reactionary manipulations of that fear, which is the fear of anarchy and revolution. It is put to wicked use against the same general welfare conservative opinion seeks to protect. Forced to acknowledge Hitler's enmity, conservatives are loath to admit that even as he surrendered in Europe, he succeeded in America. Let conservatives evaluate the impudent candor of fascism in Argentina today and be reminded that the heroic survival of our liberty is no proof of its immortality. Our liberty has every day to be saved from marauders whose greed is for all things possessed by the people. Care of these possessions is the hope of life on this planet. They are living things. They grow, these fair possessions of democracy. And nothing but death can stop that growth. Let the yearners for the past, the willfully childish, learn now the facts of life. The first of which is the fact of that growth. In our hemisphere, the growing has begun, but only just begun. America can write her name across this century, and so she will if we, the people, brown and black and red, rise now to the great occasion of our brotherhood. It will take courage. It calls for the doing of great deeds, which means the dreaming of great dreams. Giving the world back to its inhabitants is too big a job for the merely practical. The architects of freedom are always capable of hope. The lawmakers of true democracy are true believers. They believe quite simply in the people, in all of them. Only the devout deserve the trust of government, for only the devout can face the unimaginable vistas of man's destiny. God grant them steadfast hope and the rest of us enduring patience. For we must not expect from any leadership a shiny, ready-made millennium in our time. No one of us will live to see a blameless peace. We strive and pray and die for what will be here when we are gone. Our children's children are the ancestors of a free people. We send our greetings ahead of us to them. To history yet unmade, our greetings. To the generations sleeping in our loins. Be of good heart. The fight is worth it. That just about means that my time is up. When my time's up, it's time for me to say goodbye and to invite you please to join me at the same time, at the same station, next week. Until then, thanking you for your attention, I remain as always obediently yours. This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.
Lear on Tuned to Yesterday, an ABC broadcast from August 11th, 1946 on ABC. It's true history in this hour of Tuned to Yesterday. Now coming up next, a brief from newsman Elmer Davis, heard on the CBS network from February 12th, 1940, with a mention first of a Supreme Court decision standing up for four African Americans accused of murder.
8:55 Eastern Time, and Columbia and its affiliated stations bring you Elmer Davis and the news.
Among all the commemorations of Lincoln's birthday, perhaps the most appropriate was that of the Supreme Court, which re-emphasized the protection of the Bill of Rights in setting aside the convictions of four Florida Negroes sentenced to death for murder. They claimed that their confessions had been obtained by beating. Justice Black of Alabama, reading a unanimous opinion, said that, I quote, "The courts stand as havens of refuge for those who might otherwise suffer because they are helpless, weak, outnumbered, or nonconforming victims of prejudice and public excitement. No higher duty, no more solemn responsibility rests upon this court than that of translating into living law and maintaining this constitutional shield, deliberately planned and contrived for the benefit of every human being subject to our Constitution of whatever race, creed, or persuasion," end quote. Perhaps in response to President Roosevelt's criticism of Russia before the Youth Congress on Saturday, the Russian papers broke out today in a unanimous attack on America, though their criticisms were aimed not at Mr. Roosevelt, but at Vice President Garner, Congressman Dyes, and various private citizens. They repeated the argument that American capitalists are fattening on war trade, and one of them said that Undersecretary of State Wells, on his approaching trip to Europe, would be the traveling salesman of American imperialism, preparing the way for American entry into the war. While all Central Europe appears to be almost paralyzed by a cold wave that promises to be the worst in 100 years, the war still goes on in Finland, with the Red Army attacking the Mannerheim line today in great force at three points. The assault in the Suma sector, described by our correspondent Mr. Hartrich as the keystone of the line, continued for its 12th consecutive day under cover of terrific artillery fire and bombing raids. But at the same time, Russian forces moving on the ice of Lake Ladoga and of the Gulf of Finland attempted to turn both flanks of the line. These attacks also were made in heavy force and supported by a long artillery barrage, but the Finns claim that they have all been repulsed and that 72 tanks were destroyed in the day's fighting. The neutrals suffered all the ship losses today. One Swedish and one Estonian freighter sunk, both by torpedoes. The crew of the Estonian ship was rescued by a Swedish collier, which was machine-gunned by German planes but escaped. And another British trawler is reported sunk in last Saturday's air attack. Germany and Russia today signed a trade treaty, which, according to German expectations, as reported by Russell Hill from Berlin earlier this evening, will compensate for all the commerce Germany has lost by the blockade. Russian transportation will have to improve considerably before this hope is realized. The Germans will trade machinery and metal goods for oil, ore, and fodder. And one of the clauses provides that Germany will set up in Russia an oil refinery and a synthetic rubber factory and will teach the Russians how to run them. A contingent of Australian and New Zealand troops of unknown but apparently considerable size arrived in Egypt today, and according to most reports is expected to strengthen the forces the Allies are keeping in the Near East in case of possible German or Russian attack this spring. It's possible, however, that these troops may eventually come to the Western Front, as their kinsmen did in the last war. This cold wave, freezing most of the inundated areas in the Netherlands clear to the bottom, would make an attack on that country easier if the Germans are contemplating it. In Japan, the 2,600th anniversary of the legendary founding of the empire was celebrated by the emperor with a rescript to his subjects in general language, which did not, as some reports had forecast, put the imperial authority formally behind the present Chinese policy. General Hatta, the war minister, admitted in the Diet today that the so-called China incident is likely to continue for years, and the tone of Japanese news stories from southeastern China bears him out. A week ago, these stories spoke of 150,000 Chinese troops encircled and trapped in the mountains. But instead of reporting the capture of this immense force, the Japanese dispatches now say that Japanese troops have abandoned captured positions and returned to their bases, letting the trapped Chinese go, it appears. It is now believed that the new Japanese-controlled Chinese government of Wang Qingwei will be proclaimed near the end of this month. It has been put off again and again since December. And General Hata said today that to meet the labor shortage in Japan, the army might, following Hitler's precedent with the Poles, import Chinese prisoners of war to do the work. Japan gave notice today that its treaty of arbitration and conciliation with the Netherlands would be terminated, but said there was no political motive and emphasized friendship for the Dutch.
This is the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Elmer Davis and the news from February 12, 1940 on CBS. Davis would leave his newscasting post after America became involved in the Second World War to serve as chief of the Office of War Information, setting guidelines as to what could or couldn't be said on the air, like troop locations and other obvious information, including not-so-obvious local weather forecasts in the States in case of an enemy planning attack. The Second World War also began a slow turn of the tide on radio in terms of tolerance and prejudice. As American stance in the Second World War was to fight for freedom and equality, so should it be exemplified on our shores with all of its citizens. To this end, new censorship on radio was imposed to show respect and broadcast without outright hatred or disparaging portrayal of African Americans. Yet programs still existed that would touch anyone's nerve today. Regardless of how slow the change was, it was in some part the power of radio that did, when given the chance, speak the truths of our nation at that time on and off the entertainment and news clocks. And that wraps up this hour of True History on Tuned to Yesterday. Be sure to be with us next time for more great programs from radio's past. Until our next hour together, I'm Mark Levonier. Thanks for listening.